All right, bonjour, everybody. I should have said bon dia. Okay. So first of all, thanks for being here today, and thanks for y'all for your hard work. Do that publicly in front of this audience. So how the panel will be run, I'm going to provide an introduction for the project, present the panelists, explaining the genesis of the translation project, then describing the scope and contents of the collection. So first, I will introduce the participants and the panelists. We'll start here. Dr. James Krause is an associate professor of Spanish and Portuguese at BYU. He specializes in comparative Latin American literature, translation studies, and fantastic literature, which is a genre, not simply saying it's good. He served a mission to Osorno, Chile from 1997 to 1999. He earned his BA and MA in Spanish from BYU, another MA in Portuguese from Vanderbilt, and a dual emphasis PhD in Spanish and Portuguese from Vanderbilt. He enjoys traveling, especially to Brazil, where he does most of his research. He and his wife have three children. He enjoys playing guitar, songwriting, and performing in his department's faculty band. And they're good if you ever get down there. Dr. Krause was one of the three faculty co-sponsors / co-supervisors of the translation project. Another participant, Audrey Lowther. She is a freelance Spanish and Portuguese translator. She graduated from BYU as a double major in Spanish translation and Portuguese studies in 2018. She served a mission in Sao Paulo from September 13 to April 15. She's not able to be here today, but she was the original student project manager, coordinating the translations and helping to organize the other students in terms of workflow and quality control. Our next panelist here is Suzanne Shibuta. She is a recent graduate from BYU, where she received her bachelor's degree in linguistics and a master's degree in Portuguese, with an emphasis in Luso-Brazilian literatures. She served a mission in Japan from January 2013 to July 2014, where she first discovered her love of languages, learning both Japanese and Portuguese. She enjoys running and being outdoors, as well as spending time with her family. So following Audrey's graduation, Suzanne took over as a student project manager and continued to work on the translation and revision of the interviews and the creation of the metadata documents that will accompany them. She has been instrumental in bringing the project to its now near completion. Our final panelist over here, Marcelo Lemi, is a master's student at BYU studying accounting. He served a two-year mission in Brasilia from 2014 to 2016. He has most recently visited Brazil as part of an internship at the Brazilian Studies Institute at the University of Sao Paulo. Marcelo enjoys being outdoors and is getting married this August. So. His grandparents were interviewed by Mark Grover, who we'll talk about in a second, another collection of interviews conducted with early church members in Portugal. Another person who isn't here today, John Murphy. He's an associate librarian and curator of the 20th century Mormon and Western manuscripts in the L. Tom Perry Special Collections at Harold B. Lee Library. He was the second of the three faculty co-sponsors of the project and the one who brought the need for the translations to my attention. He would be presenting with us today, but he is currently out of the country with his family and a study abroad in England. So we excuse John today. Finally, my name is Matt Hill. I am the Latin American and Iberian Area Studies Librarian at the HBLL, and I'm the third co-sponsor of the Translation Project. I specialize in colonial Latin American history, culture, and literature, though in my responsibilities as librarian, I necessarily have to take a wider view of the field, hence my interest in work in Portuguese studies. So with those introductions, I'll now briefly explain the origin of the translation project and the scope of the collection. After I finish my remarks, Dr. Krause will present a brief and schematic history of the church in South America generally and Brazil specifically, followed by Suzanne and Marcelo, who will talk collectively about their experiences translating the interviews, including some common themes found in them and a few highlights that they wanted to mention. Following Suzanne and Marcelo's discussion, Dr. Krause will go into more detail about two specific themes in the interviews and some possible implications for the study of the church in Brazil, supplemented by comments from Suzanne and Marcelo. And after that, we'll take questions and have a bit more informal discussion together. All right, so the things that we translated were part of what is called the Mark L. Grover Oral History Interviews with Latter-day Saints in Brazil. That's the title of the collection in the library catalog, and the call number is MSS6799. So if you look on the library website, that's where you can find it. The collection consists of 30 interviews, originally created by Mark Grover, who was my predecessor in this position as librarian. He and Fred Williams, another professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, carried out in the 1970s and 1980s among Latter-day Saints in Brazil. And go ahead and go forward. So here is the name of the interviewees that appear in this particular collection. Both Mark and Fred have done other interviews that aren't in the collection. That was one of Mark's big passions, is interviewing people in Brazil. But these represent pioneering figures in the church in Brazil, and a number of the members of the project and other people on BYU campus have personal connections to these individuals. Go ahead and move it forward. So in the collections itself, there are the transcripts of the interviews. They have been cleaned up for readability purposes. Mark did that a while ago. In addition to the actual recordings itself on tape. So if you want to hear the interviews as Mark and Fred are giving them, then you can do that. And so the Portuguese, the transcripts, excuse me, are in Portuguese and not in English. And so in advance. Originally, the idea of translating this collection was brought to me by John Murphy out of Special Collections. He had been contacted by a scholar out of a small university in Colorado who is interested in African Americans, Brazil, priesthood, all those kinds of things associated with LDS history. And so he was wondering if there was any plans to translate those so that he could research them, obviously not being a Portuguese speaker. And so John approached me, and I was like, hey, well, that sounds like a great opportunity. So then I contacted different Portuguese faculty in the Spanish and Portuguese department. Dr. Kraus took me up on the offer, and we started planning from there. We did some translation tests, interviewed a lot of people, and ended up hiring three students, again, Marcelo, Suzanne, and Audrey Lowther, who is not here today. Funding from it came from the library, both John's research funds, my research funds, and from the College of Humanities through Dr. Kraus. And so with that institution, I guess you could say, collaboration, we were able to fund the three students for a semester in the initial project, which took place in, what was it?
January to April last year, right?
Yeah, so January to April-ish of last year, 2018. So we were able to get a lot of things done, not everything. And then over the course of the last year, roughly, Suzanne and, to a lesser extent, me, Dr. Kraus, Marcelo, and Audrey have all contributed to the continuing of the translation project. Let's go back, please. So on here, all of these are translated except for two, the Ocidis Cabral and the Leonel de Samaya. Those are in process. They'll be completed by the end of the summer, if not earlier. So just letting you know where that's at. So in terms of what to expect once the documents are all printed and included in the collection at the HBLL, as the translations were happening, we created this document together with John Murphy in order to answer some basic questions. And so you can see here, I don't know if you can see, actually it's kind of small print. Can everyone see this or should I read it? You're good? Okay. So we have these things that we're hoping to get out of the interviews. Now obviously not everything would be included in every interview. But you know, some would have some information on some questions, some on another. And so the idea is to get basic sense of the kind of people being interviewed, their experiences, et cetera, to then later, you know, produce additional research. Also, this research and metadata document will serve as metadata, which is, you know, as you people search in the catalog, you'd be able to find specific information about the interviews themselves. So these will also be included in the collection when everything is, again, is all printed out and cataloged according to special collection standards. So, all right. So that's my part. Again, this is just what the biggest thing that I want to take out of this is, if you guys are interested in doing research on Brazil, you know, Latter-day Saint history in the 20th century, you know, these things are open and available for you. They're now in English if you didn't have the Portuguese skills, and so spread the word to anyone who is out there. So now I'll turn the time over to James, and then we'll go from there. Thanks.
Well, thank you for being here. This is my first time at MHA, and I feel a bit like an interloper. Maybe the imposter syndrome never truly goes away. Because, you know, my area is in literary studies, but I certainly have an interest in the development of the church in throughout Latin America, and specifically in Brazil. I, as an undergraduate, I met Mark Grover on a number of occasions. My wife and I did a self-reliance internship, and he shared at least 100 pages of transcribed interviews that he had conducted with young single adults in Brazil to help us understand the kinds of issues that demographic was facing regarding employment and education and activity in the church and things like that. So, and I imagine many of you know Mark. He's going to be here, or he's at least presenting tomorrow, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful person. So I don't know my audience, so I don't know to what extent you are familiar with the history of the church in South America and in Brazil specifically. Due to time constraints, this is going to be superficial and maybe a little reductive, so I apologize for that. But for those who are like, well, I don't really, you know, I kind of know the big contours, but hopefully this will help out. Okay, so in the 1850s, Parley Pratt travels to Chile accompanied by his pregnant wife and Rufus Allen, Phoebe Soper Pratt and Rufus Allen. Due to language challenges, limitations on religious liberty in Chile, soaring inflation in Chile, and the political challenges in Chile, the work does not progress at all. They have their son dies, they bury him in Chile, and they return home with a sense of failure. Elder Pratt expresses a desire to travel to Peru, since his original charge was to teach the Lamanites, and he learns, oh, there are more native people in Peru than in Chile, but this, of course, is thwarted due to his murder in 1857. So it's not until, oh yeah, there's a picture after each thing, just... So you can go ahead and, yeah, or, yeah, but then do the next one. There we go. So in July of 1923, there's an unofficial visit to South America by assistant church historian Andrew Jensen, originally from Denmark. In fact, he asked the brethren if they would sponsor his trip, and they say no. He's like, well, I'm just going to go anyway. So he does. And he visits Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil. He concludes that the church can now overcome earlier impediments, namely the language barrier and the lack of religious freedom that had existed in some of those countries. And as many of you know, Brigham Young had encouraged colonization in northern Mexico. So by this point, there are members of the church who speak fluent Spanish. So this is why in 1924, around there, Charles Nibley, who's a member of the First Presidency, he strongly encourages church leaders to send a delegation to Argentina. And they call, or they assign Elder Melvin J. Ballard, who's a junior member of the 12. He had been a mission president in Montana, working with the indigenous population there. Rulin Wells, who spoke German, and Ray Pratt, who spoke Spanish. He grew up in the Mormon colonies in Mexico. And they're both members of the First Council of the 70. So they're sent to Buenos Aires to primarily work with the German immigrant population, which was very small, but that initially was where they started preaching the gospel. So on December 25th, 1925, they dedicate the continent of South America for missionary work. In 1926, in January, Elder Wells returns to the States due to a brain hemorrhage, leaving Ballard and Pratt without their German translator. So in July of that year, the work kind of slows, and they determine to return to the United States. And it's in this last meeting in Buenos Aires that Elder Ballard gives this prophecy that we've heard before. So the work will go forth slowly for a time, just as the oak grows slowly from an acorn. It will not shoot up in a day, and as does the sunflower that grows quickly and thus dies. Thousands will join here. It will be divided into more than one mission and will be one of the strongest in the church. The work here is the smallest that it will ever be. The South American mission will become a power in the church. Okay, so now where does Brazil fit into this? Between 1913 and 1928, the historical records only show two families who are members of the church. They were German immigrants and converts in Germany. They moved to southern Brazil. They hear about each other. One family moves to the town of the other so that they're close by. And then during that period, Reinhold Stuff, who's the president of the South American mission centered in Buenos Aires, who's a German immigrant, he sends German language missionaries to work with this immigrant population in Joinville, Brazil. In February of 1935, the Brazil mission is established and continues to target this small group of German immigrants. In 1938, during the Estado Novo, quasi-fascist government of Getúlio Vargas, the Brazilian government bans the use of non-Portuguese languages in public gatherings. So the mission quickly switches to Portuguese. And there were only maybe 20,000 German immigrants in Joinville anyway. It wasn't really going to blossom, maybe like they hoped. In the 1940s, the Book of Mormon is translated into Portuguese. The church is officially recognized in Brazil and receives tax-exempt status. In the 1950s, Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price are translated into Portuguese. And then these are retranslated in the early 80s with the church's correlation efforts. The missionaries focus primarily on European immigrants in the southern regions of Brazil and are discouraged and sometimes banned from teaching and baptizing individuals with African ancestry. In 1954, President David L. McKay visits the South American mission. In the 60s, branches are finally established in the Northeast, which is where the majority of Afro-Brazilian descendants lived at that time, but the issue of racial discrimination remains in effect. Elder Spencer W. Kimball organizes the São Paulo stake, the first stake in South America, in May of 66. And then in 1967, the policy on race and priesthood is changed, presuming non-African ancestry in individuals, except when there is strong evidence to the contrary. So people who actually do have African descent are baptized in the church, and many, some of the men receive the priesthood. However, in the 1970s, lineage lessons are included to ensure investigators do not have any sub-Saharan African ancestry. So in March of 1975, President Kimball announces plans to construct a temple in São Paulo, the first in South America. And as we know, in June of 1978, the revelation on priesthood removes the restriction on black men holding the priesthood. And then October of 1978, the São Paulo temple is dedicated. And this was the best photo I could find of that joyous occasion. But there it is. Okay, so in the 1980s, we see more proselyting expanding in the northeast of Brazil. And we'll talk a little bit more here in a minute about the demographics of that area. And so the church begins to grow quickly in that region. And then, a few milestones of the church in Brazil, even though these occur after the period of these interviews in the collection. So in 1985, Hélio da Rocha Camargo is called as the first general authority from Brazil. In 1990, Elvésio Martins is the first general authority of African descent to be called to the church. And his interview, it's a 40-page interview, and that's in the collection. It's very fascinating. He and his wife spoke with Mark for hours. And then in 2018, Ulisses Suarez is the first Latin American to be called to the 12. Okay, just some stats here about the church in Brazil. These are self-reported numbers, which we know can, I don't know, present certain challenges when it comes to how we define membership or affiliation or activity, things like that. But what we can see is that starting in the early 80s, there is exponential growth of the church in Brazil. And this number in 2010, two things. I think that while the change, you know, the 1978 revelation may have affected that, I think the bigger socio-historical issue was that from 1964 to 1985, Brazil had a military dictatorship. Now, the church was able to operate during that time, but in 1985, there's just a general democratic opening up. They call it the abertura. There's a new constitution that's written. I think that had as much to do with church expansion in Brazil as any change in policies or doctrinal interpretations. So let's go over here. These are these numbers are from October of last year, except one, which I'll mention. Again, reported by the church. So I think that, you know, sometimes the church membership records are not the best indication of activity or affiliation, but when it comes to physical facilities, the construction of meeting houses, temples, the creation of units, wards, and branches, I think that can be a good barometer or a good indication of where the church is. So these numbers were reported by the church last October, and I recently saw in a newsroom report that the church now says 1.4 million members. The reason why this is problematic, and just a little parenthetical here, is that in 2010, the Brazilian census presents some very conflicting numbers. So in 2010, just a little over 250,000 Brazilians self-identified as Latter-day Saints. And this could be due to, you know, any number of reasons. Maybe the head of household isn't a member of the church. But again, you know, 250,000 versus 1.4 million members there, that's a big discrepancy. But there are 34 missions, 354 family history centers, 268 stakes, over 2,000 congregations. And as of just last week, with the dedication of the Fortaleza Temple, there are 7 functioning temples, with another in Rio under construction and 3 more announced. So that's a very brief overview of the church in South America and Brazil, which provides some context to the interview. So now we'll turn the time over to Suzanne and Marcelo to talk about the translation process.
So thanks to Dr. Krauss for that brief introduction. I actually had a comment to say about that 1.4 million members in the church. So I served my mission in Brazil, and that is definitely probably something that's true in the sense that like 1.4 million members were baptized, but there aren't 1.4 million members active. We grab lists of members in a ward or, you know, like in a unit, and we go and visit those houses, and you know, either they weren't there or they said that they didn't want the visits anymore. So I believe that 1.4 million members do exist, but maybe active, not so much. Anyway, so we're going to talk about the translation process. Suzanne's going to talk about the audio tapes for a bit, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. So like Dr. Hill mentioned, the translation process really started when Mark Grover conducted these interviews, and they were on tapes. And from the tapes, these tapes were transcribed by a native Portuguese speaker. And then we had PDF forms of those, and then these PDFs were converted into Word documents. And anytime you go through so many levels of changing a document, no matter how true to it you try to stay, there's always something that gets a little bit off. And so that was an interesting part of the translation process for me, would be to like read something and be like, that's not the word. And so in your head, you're like thinking of all the Portuguese words that sound really similar to that word that could be messed up when someone was speaking or hearing it. And I myself didn't have a chance to listen to the tapes, but it was interesting to see in the documents that it does really have that flow of someone speaking. And every single interview had a different person's voice that came through.
Right, and to speak to that too, it was a bit of a challenge to translate those interviews because when we talk, we don't really talk very structurally. So translating, you know, one sentence that may go half a page down, you know, that's kind of a challenge trying to, you know, keep in line what the message is that's being, you know, sent across. But like Matt talked about, we also collected some metadata. And so we did 30 interviews, but some of those interviews included more than just one person. So there were couples, there were friends. So there were 27 males and 10 females. There were people of Brazilian, Afro, Brazilian, German, Italian, Native Indian, Japanese, Paraguayan, Portuguese, Spanish, and Yugoslavian descent. So people from all over the place. Most of them were born in Brazil. There were a few who were born outside of Brazil, like in Germany. But you know, their parents or their grandparents came from these other places, like Japan or Spain. So that was really interesting too, to see that come through in the stories that they talked about. And
And then another big part of the project was the reviewing and the feedback. And so what we did as we translated interviews, after we translated one, someone else within our group of students was assigned to review that interview. So we always had someone different going through and checking that. And I think that helped a lot to kind of keep everything uniform across the interviews, because everyone has a different method of translating. But when all of us were working on the interviews and going through and making sure everything was okay, I think it helped to make sure that there wasn't any patterns of errors throughout the translation process.
Yeah, speaking to that too, we started to organize a glossary. So we would come across different words and phrases in Portuguese that maybe one of us didn't know, but the other one did know. And so with our Google Docs, or just on the internet, we'd have a glossary of different words that we didn't know, and then we would go in and see if there were words that we did know that other people didn't, and then we'd help collaborate that way as well. But I'll be talking about that in just a sec. Audrey, who's not here with us, who was our project manager, she did have some things to say. So to the effect of reviewing and feedback, she said this: our meetings were also an opportunity to discuss any issues we were having as we reviewed our team members' translations. So about the glossary that came from that. This was a very positive experience because we all try to make our comments constructive and be accepting of any comments on our own work. Marcelo and Suzanne really did make this part a very positive experience. They were great to work with.
Did you add that just because you wanted to hear how great you were?
No, I just totally forgot that was in there.
I just want to say how awesome I am. Sorry. Yeah.
Round table. If anything, Audrey was great. She worked a lot. She was instrumental to the success of this project. So our glossary included different terminologies, as you can see up there on the slide. There are Portuguese terms and phrases, religions, Latter-day Saint vernacular, education, work, and idiomatic phrases.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that was nice about the glossary, especially when it comes to, like for me, idiomatic phrases, that's probably like the funnest thing about a translation too. Like we have the example up there, fazer uma vaquinha. And if you put that into Google Translate, it would probably say something about like to make a little cow or something similar. But what it means is to like pitch in money. So if you're going, like these interviews aren't something you can just stick in a translation machine and pull it out, because it's day-to-day conversation, they're using these idioms, and some of them, and similar things happened with church terminology, because these interviews came from the 80s, we were reading stuff about primary, about like the arrows and the shields, and we were like, we have no clue what this was, and so there was a lot of I spoke to a lot of members in Brazil that had been members all of their lives that are now like in their 50s and 60s, and it was through them that we were able to figure out, what does this mean? Like, I've never heard of this, and there really wasn't any church records that we could find that referenced some of the older terminology like that.
Yeah, one of the terms, one of the acronyms actually that really took me a while to actually figure out what it was AMM, which in Portuguese it means Associação de Melhoramentos Mútuos, which in English is mutual. And so they'd be talking about AMM all throughout the interview, and be like, what is AMM? What are they even talking about? So different methods were taken to like figure out what everything meant. Like Suzanne said, she talked to people in Brazil who had been members their whole lives, who lived during that time. Some of them we had to just go on the internet and look it up and try to hope that something will pop up.
Sometimes it did, though, too.
Sometimes it did.
If I could just pop in right here, talk over the podium. I remember Audrey and I were looking for a particular term that in the end, it had to do with self-reliance, but we had no idea. It was like, what is this thing? So, like, searching blogs, searching, all just scouring Google, asking people all over the place. And I'd have to look up the term again. It's in some of the interviews. But in the end, between me and Suzanne, we were able to find what we believed was the DTA. Yeah, is it the DTA, something like that? Yeah. The appropriate agency, you know, because, you know, these programs come and go. And so it's important to have that. That perspective and those all the research tools at our disposal. And I think it coming back to what your point was, Suzanne, I mean, those idiomatic phrases, this project required a human presence, a human touch, you know. I mean, you could have put it into Google, but it would have been terrible, and you would have had making a little cow, and you're like, so, you know, just all sorts of bad things happen. So, and just going to praise the students, they really did an excellent job of bringing out those difficult to translate, culturally specific references and turns of phrase, et cetera. So we're very glad for their activities in that regard.
Thank you. So this is what Audrey had to say about the glossary. In our first team meeting, we discussed some terms we had been having trouble with, mostly names of old church organizations, and found that for a few of the terms, one team member had come up with an answer for the other's problem. We decided that starting an online collaborative glossary would be the easiest way to work together to define difficult terms and then keep track of those terms. So this right here is a little bit of a snippet of our glossary. You have on the left the word in Portuguese. So for example, if you go down to like the bottom third of the page, there's AMM that I was talking about. The column next to it is the English translation. And then after that is where we the source where we got that translation from. So in this case, AMM we found from a native speaker. And then the last column is the context, which was found, where that word was found in the interviews. So it's just a little bit of an example of how our glossary was organized in that way. And then this right here is just something that I found really interesting. I'd never known this, but this is just a breakout of the school system in Brazil. And so you'd be reading these interviews and they'd be talking about different grades in school, but obviously they have different words for that in Portuguese. So just being able to find a visual representation of that helped to put in order the events of what was happening during the interviews. Matt.
Okay. So a little bit about our personal insights for the interviews. I didn't serve my mission in Brazil. I promise I was qualified to translate these interviews.
Her Portuguese is excellent.
We tested them.
Yes, I took a test, so I promise I'm okay to do these. But for me, it was really interesting because my only interaction with church members has been through my husband's family. And so I didn't have the experience of, being in Brazil and learning about the church history and the culture. And something else that the interviews really did for me was kind of break stereotypes of church membership in Brazil. Because, when someone gets called to Brazil, it's like, oh, you're going to baptize like hundreds of people. Versus my mission, it was like, oh, you're going to Japan. Like, I hope you brought your tissues because you might get like one person. So for me, I always had that image in mind of like Brazil is super easy to baptize. No one stays in the church very long. And reading these interviews, there are definitely cases where that happens. You know, a lot of people get baptized, and it is related to that Brazilian culture of being more connected to a higher power. But for me, it showed me how incredibly strong these members were, and I don't think they get credit for that a lot of times. And so translating these interviews, it gives people who don't have that background in Brazil an insider's view of what it was like for someone to be converted to the church. You know, and we'll talk about more stuff later, but things like church callings and problems that they had with doctrine during the time, I don't think the church could have flourished as strong in Brazil as it did if the members weren't already prepared and didn't already have this incredible faith that they did to be baptized and to put their trust in these missionaries who were learning Portuguese, who didn't speak it very well. They didn't have the language programs that we have today where people already go to Brazil speaking pretty well. You know, in that time, we went with some flashcards and stood in a city center and waited. And so I just think it was a really interesting thing for me as someone that didn't have a missionary experience in South America to see how exactly that worked and learn about members' viewpoints on that.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing reading these interviews, seeing how incredible these people were. What was interesting too was some of the personal connections we had with the interviews. For example, Audrey said, I loved getting to translate the Martins interview, and that we talked about Elcio Martins, who's the first black African descent general authority of the church. She said her mission president was his son, and so learning about his experience growing up, about the gospel and his family was very interesting. In my case, there were a few personal connections. There's Harry Klein, who was my mission president's mission president. There is Gelson Pizidani, who was one of the mission presidents of my mission again. And there's José Lombardi, who was actually a patriarch who my grandparents in Portugal got their patriarchal blessings from José Lombardi. So that's pretty amazing. Can we go on?
So there were a lot of recurring themes within the interviews, and one that I noticed really quickly was church callings. And not just like church callings, because within the church we all get callings, but how fast members were given callings with a lot of responsibility. Like someone would be baptized, they said, I got baptized on Saturday, and on Sunday I was called as a Sunday school president. And like, I can only imagine, especially here in Utah where we have so many members, and I've been in wards where they start making up these callings and just so that everyone can do something. But in Brazil, someone would be a member for a week and then they would give them a manual and say, you can do this, brother. And so to me, it was really incredible. I put an example up there, Walter Guedes de Queiroz. He was an example of a member who received these callings. He was a counselor in the bishopric, he was a state president, but he went on to say in his interview that he was a counselor in the bishopric before he could even receive the priesthood because of the doctrine regarding those of African descent in Brazil. So not just, people weren't just receiving big callings, they were receiving callings sometimes without the priesthood because they couldn't, but they still had to step up and fill these roles with shoes that were often really big, and they did it. And I think that's what's incredible. As you read through these interviews, you see, I mean, probably 99% of these interviews, especially with the male members, they start out as like a Sunday school president, and by the end of the interview, they've been mission presidents and stake presidents, and they're doing these incredible things. And so it was really interesting to me just to see the progression that this all happened in, you know, 10, 20 years. They've held so many huge callings because the church was so new, and they needed new members to step up and to fill those shoes.
Yeah, and I think adding to Dr. Cross's point about the population growth of church members in Brazil, I think that was instrumental to that growth. Being able to nurture an early group of leaders who have callings just like the day after they're baptized, being able to strengthen their standing and their testimony and their ability in the church was instrumental to letting the church grow in such a way that it did in Brazil. Some other themes that we noticed were the lineaging or the lineage, which Dr. Krause is going to talk about. Mm-hmm. A lot of the members that were interviewed were employed by the church, which they had mixed reactions about. Some thought it was great being able to be around a lot of church authorities and working for the church in that way. Others thought it wasn't so great because the pay wasn't all that good and they could have gotten a job elsewhere where they could have gotten paid more. Or maybe their associations with the church leaders wasn't that great. And sometimes I think of people who have a high status, I guess you can say, in the church as people who are perfect and great and amazing, when in reality, they're just people, they're human beings. And so reading these interviews and getting to see the experience of the Brazilians in those positions really helped me to realize that, yeah, people are just people and they're going to do people things. Another theme that we saw was a culture clash with Americans. So during the military dictatorship of this time, it was very anti-America in a sense. And here's just a quote underneath of what someone said. You know, like Suzanne said, when you go to Brazil, if you get a mission call to Brazil, it's going to say, oh, you're going to baptize so many people because people just live in these little huts and favelas and it's all rainforest, which is totally not true. I was in a desert. It is not rainforest at all. And then fellowshipping as well, which also goes to the growth of the church. And they were really big about including newly baptized members and trying to make them feel like an integral part of the church unit. And I think that really helped to fortify, again, that early base of church members and contribute to that growth later on.
And so just to, I guess, wrap up our part, some of the highlights. The highlights for me were really the testimonies of early members in Brazil. And some of these conversion stories within the interviews are absolutely amazing. I mean, you read about people, a lot of people had dreams where they received a direct answer that they saw Christ and he said, you need to join the church. And this member talks about waking up and knowing he needed to do that and calling the missionary, and the missionary said, I already know. Like, you're getting baptized. And so going through these interviews and just learning about testimonies and seeing this, not just the faith of the saints, but their faith throughout continued trials, throughout waiting for a temple. A lot of the interviewees went to the Salt Lake Temple before the temple in São Paulo was constructed, because that was the only way they could be sealed to their families. And so it's really touching for me to go through and to read the testimonies of the members. So if you can't get through the whole interview, usually like the last page has a really good testimony from the interviewers, where they just say, where they show us how strong their faith is, you know, despite getting callings when they might not have been prepared, or accepting doctrines that might have been hard for them at the time. All of these interviewers have incredible testimonies of the gospel, and it was very humbling to translate their interviews.
So my highlight started during the actual process of me getting the job, because like Matt said, we had to take a test and do some translations. And part of those translation tests were excerpts of the interviews that we had to translate eventually. And mine was from Harry Klein, who I mentioned earlier, who was my mission president. Fun fact about him, he was actually the mission president to the most baptizing mission in the world in church history. During his three-year tenure, they baptized 18,000 people. But anyway, one of the excerpts from his interview talks about a sister missionary that he was mission president to, who had been shot and who died during her mission. But her last words were to another elder, Elder, go on Sunday and please baptize my families. And so it's really amazing to see the dedication of these missionaries, of these church members. And it's amazing to see, when I read that for the first time during my test, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to be translating? What am I getting myself into? So that's, if anything else, I think that's one reason to go and actually read the interviews, because this is quite an amazing story of a sister missionary being shot, and then her last words were to her dedication to the missionary work. And I have the quote up here if you want to come and read it later. I don't think I'm going to read it now because it's a little bit long, but it's up here if you want, and I'll be here afterwards.
We'll be here all day.
But yeah, I think that wraps up our part. Dr. Kuss.
Okay, thank you. I just have to say this is a huge highlight for me. When I received the initial email from Matt, I thought, well, okay, you know, my tenure portfolio, or no, I think I had received tenure, yeah, by that point. And I was like, because how many, is anybody else here from BYU? Anyway, the when I started, the message was always kind of, yeah, if you want to do Mormon studies stuff, wait until after you have tenure. You don't want to build your career on that unless you're in religious studies or in history and that's your assignment. And I think that's wise. But when this came along, I was like, oh, this would be a fun project to be involved in. I was tangentially aware of these interviews that Mark and that Fred Williams had done in the 70s and 80s. But being able to work with my former and current students has been just a really fun project. And I'm not going to gush too much, but the mentoring process and seeing them, especially, you know, the peer mentoring efforts, they have really, you know, they really took the ball and ran with it. And we've kind of provided a little bit of guidance, but it's been definitely more hands-off than hands-on.
Yeah, mind if I say something about that? Just the nature of our work, of necessity, the project was hands-off. It's like, there's this thing, take it, we'll see what you can do. And, you know, we would meet with them every once in a while, but really this, with the exception of the funding, this was a very student-driven project. And so, again, they really did step up to the responsibilities that were given to him.
Okay, so this topic of lineaging or lineage was something that I was vaguely aware of, but I didn't have any specific, you know, details regarding how it was applied, interpreted, understood in the Brazilian context. And you know, Mark Grover published an article in Dialogue in 1984 that at the time, I mean, it's still probably one of the best articles on this topic. But diving into these interviews, you can see how much of a struggle it was for certain members. It caused several people, you know, cognitive dissonance. And anyway, we'll get into it. So as a point of context, here is just like a really, really, again, superficial, reductive overview of the history of slavery in Brazil. But Brazil was the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery in 1888. Portuguese settlers initially enslaved Amerindians, but they started importing African slaves in the mid-16th century because the indigenous people, they knew the land. If they could escape, they could disappear. And they apparently didn't make as good of workers as you know, slaves from the west coast of Africa. So from the early 1500s until abolition in 1888, nearly 5 million African slaves were brought to Brazil. And this represents roughly 40% of all slaves brought to the Americas. So 40% to one country. Empires of sugar plantations in the Northeast and gold and diamond mines in the current state of Minas Gerais were built on the backs of forced slave labor. And here you can see just, I mean, how much of the transatlantic slave trade was directed to Brazil. So curiously, interracial marriage and interracial mixing were much more common among the Portuguese and then the Brazilians than it was among their counterparts in Spanish America and British America. Consequently, Brazil has one of the most racially diverse populations in the Americas. According to the 1980 Brazilian census, and I wanted to pull this data so that it reflected the time when these interviews were conducted, only a little over half of Brazil's population self-identified as white. And we're going to talk a little more about what that means to self-identify as white. So 6% black, 39% mixed race, or what they call pardo, which includes, and these are some terms in Portuguese, but just kind of a spectrum of terms, mulatto, which is basically mulatto, índio, which is indigenous, mestiço, mameluco, caboclo, which is mixed European and Amerindian, or Cafuzo, which is mixed African and Amerindian. So, and then, even the terms that demographers and statisticians use today are not necessarily politically correct, because they'll use preto, which is color and not race. Negro is race, preto is color. And they'll use amarelo, or yellow, for Asians. So anyway, the conceptualization of racial identity in Brazil was much different than in the United States. In Brazil, even to this day, physical characteristics and skin tone and color determine racial identity more than ancestry. This proved particularly challenging in the early years of the church in Brazil. So from those early days until the revocation of the priesthood ban in 1978, missionaries were discouraged and, as I mentioned, sometimes even banned from even teaching individuals who looked like they had African descent. As Mark Grover explains, missionaries would scrutinize, quote, the color of the skin, eyes, and hair, the shape of the nose and face, color lines on the hands and feet, and the texture of their hair, close quote. So in 1967, this policy softened somewhat, putting the onus of it more on the church rather than having these lengthy genealogical interviews. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But for years, individuals who wanted to join the church, they had to prove through genealogical research that they did not have African heritage. Now, these policies caused members pain and cognitive dissonance, as Grover observes. In these parts of the world, the priesthood issue was much more than an occasional embarrassment or a matter for theological debate. It was a very personal issue which had to be confronted often. Many members struggled with this policy, which openly discriminated against family members, friends, and occasionally themselves. It was also a source of conflict between local members and missionaries, and many times resulted in limited growth and development for the church. So of the 30 interviews, over a third discussed this issue in some detail. And several of the interviewees, presumably white, didn't like the policy, but since it didn't impact them much directly, they accepted it, or they provide scriptural explanations justifying the policy. And many of these scriptural explanations we now come to understand as just being based on racist beliefs. So what we'd like to do now, and I actually was going to ask for some audience participation, but since they're recording it, I think we'll just take turns reading some of these quotes. Because it's one thing to talk about a collection and say what's in it. It's another to see textual examples. And so this issue of the linhagem de Caim, or, you know, I guess we would kind of, you know, the seed of Cain is how we would refer to it. Now, they didn't necessarily see it as being, you know, direct descendants of Cain, but because of the dark skin, it was the curse of Cain. I'm not going to say necessarily who these people were in the context of, but just know that there are, like Suzanne mentioned, many of these people held important high visibility callings in the church. You have a group of individuals who were official, they were hired by the church, and they were official interpreters and translators for general authorities, for President McKay, and then later President Kimball when they visited Brazil. So these are very committed, deeply committed members of the church. And so to listen to kind of what they say about this issue, I think, is very enlightening. Let's just go down the line. We'll each take a turn.
Okay. So this is from Alfredo Lima Weiss. He said, I accepted it out of obedience. I had to be Mormon, but did I feel a sense of well-being in my heart about it? No. Do you know what it is? In my conception of God, I thought God to be of infinite goodness and understanding. I couldn't think of God separating the blacks from the whites. Not at all. Now the explanations, the punishment, all that the Bible teaches, I had to accept it. But if there really was a pit in my stomach, it was the blacks.
And then this is Flavia Garcia Erbolata, and she says, when my family learned about lineage, they were extremely revolted. My siblings didn't accept the church because of lineage. They thought it was absurd. At the time, I didn't accept it, so I accepted it this way. I didn't like it, but I put it to the side as if it were a problem to be resolved later. I didn't make it a constant in my thoughts, not at all. I didn't try looking for an answer. It was so good that I didn't worry about it.
In all my prayers, what I asked for the most was the redemption of the blacks. During many years, I asked God to give blacks redemption. It was what I wanted most. Because in Brazil, there's a connection between the Brazilian people and blacks. There doesn't exist separation. It's a complete linkage. So we didn't accept any practical reason.
I remember that to be ordained a deacon, I was interviewed by the mission president, who at the time was President William Grant Bangerter. He interviewed me. I had to show him the genealogical charts for my father, my mother, and my grandparents because there was a great deal of concern about lineage. After it was proven, because it's hard for a Brazilian to prove whether or not he has black lineage, but after at least having provided some evidence that I was not of the lineage of Cain, I was ordained a deacon.
It was the missionaries. I didn't know why.
Oh, just a quick intro to this one. So as a 14-year-old boy, Carlos was presented by his branch president to the congregation to receive the Aaronic priesthood and be ordained a deacon. The congregation sustained the proposal, but all four American missionaries opposed it because they had reason to believe he had lineage.
It was the missionaries. I didn't know why. After sacrament meeting, Brother Jason went with these missionaries and they told him why they had voted against me giving the priesthood. He called me in and said that the missionaries had told him there was a problem with my lineage and that he needed to reconsider the situation. Many months passed and no solution to the problem was presented. For me, this was a great trauma because despite everything, I hadn't become inactive. I kept going to church and, for me, it was very hard to see someone receive the priesthood because I remembered my situation and I cried a lot. But even so, I remained strong in the church.
Approximately a year after all this happened, Brother Jason called me again and said that he had prayed a lot about the problem and had fasted several times about the issue and was sure that there was no problems with my lineage and that he was going to confer upon me the Aaronic priesthood. Even later, I found out that he had designated a member of the church to become close with my family. My mother, who wasn't a member of the church, had revealed to this person facts about our ancestors, had shown him photographs, and talked about our roots. This investigation led to the discovery that the origin of this distrust that the missionaries had was a term that my mother used when she discussed our ancestors, saying that we were descendants of Bougres.
Bougres. Bougres. So the missionaries thought that Bougre meant black, because the photographs of our relatives were taken in Rio de Janeiro, and they loved the beach and had dark skin because of their tans and not because of their lineage. They understood that Bugris were black people, and because of that, they opposed my call. So the priesthood was conferred upon me, and it was a total party in the ward because everyone knew about my problem. Later, I was ordained a teacher, then a priest, and when I was 19 years old, I was ordained an elder in Brasilia. So, Brazilians would use this term bugri to refer to Amerindians who were not considered Christians by the Europeans. And I think it comes from the French to refer to heretics and things like that. So it had nothing to do with racial construction at all. Oh, this is a sad one. So, just as a point of introduction, sorry. So José Wagner Sousa talks about how his mother sent him letters while he was on his mission explaining to him that he most likely had African blood on the part of his father, who had abandoned the family when this young man was young. So it was just in her genealogical research that, and so she sends him these letters while he's on his mission, and this is how he reacts.
My mom started writing to me saying that I had lineage and that I couldn't serve a mission. But if I had been called at the time, I didn't think I did, because I had been called by the prophet. So I didn't have lineage. I didn't have any problems, but I started putting it in my head that I did and returned home. President Saito decided to suspend the use of my priesthood because he didn't know if I had lineage or not. But I had received my patriarchal blessing, and soon afterwards it came, and it said that I would hold the Melchizedek priesthood, that I would enter into the temple, and a lot of other things. So I thought, if the patriarch says these things, I must not have problems with lineage.
So this is an interesting point here. So in addition to resorting to these to genealogical research, the church would church leaders and members would also accept the declaration of lineage and a patriarchal blessing as official. So this was a spiritual way of resolving a question that also had administrative implications. And Mark's 1984 dialogue article does a good job of contextualizing how there was both, you know, the genealogical aspect, but then if a patriarch bestowed, you know, if they said, okay, you're of the house of Manasseh, then that means, well, obviously you're not. You're part of the house of Israel. Anyway, really fascinating.
Very fluid concept.
Very, very fluid. Okay, so now we're going to move to, yeah, so we've got one more interview that we're going to look at, and then I'd love to hear about this. Thank you. So now we're going to talk about Elvesio Marchins and his wife, Huda. And so they were highly educated. They were Catholic in name, but they actually practiced Kardecian Spiritism, which is a spiritualistic philosophy developed by a French educator whose pen name was Allan Kardec. Now, Spiritismo is alive and well in Brazil, even though it's fallen out of favor pretty much everywhere else. But in the United States, you know, when seances and Ouija boards were kind of in vogue, that came out of Spiritism. But it's like most philosophies or religious traditions, it's much more nuanced than some party trick. But after falling out with Spiritism, they returned to Catholicism for a brief time. They attended a Baptist church, an Anglican church, a Presbyterian church, but they never quite found that spark that called to them. So one day after a long day at work in May of 1972, so this is still 6 years before the revocation of the priesthood ban, the missionaries knocked on the Martins' door. And as the missionaries are about to leave, Elvesio brings up the topic of the church's stance on race. And this is their memory of that.
The missionaries came in and asked if they could leave a blessing.
No, go ahead. Okay. I was on the wrong slide.
The missionaries came in and asked if they could leave a blessing for our family. And I said yes, but that I would like to ask them a few questions and asked if they would be willing to answer them. And they said, why not? A prayer was said, and one of the missionaries said that I could ask what I wanted. And so, brother, I started by asking them about the issue of race, and if the church was racist. Elder McIntyre turned very red, you know. I didn't understand, sir. And then I asked, since the church was in the United States, how are blacks treated in the church? And then he laughs. You can imagine the embarrassment he felt. He turned bright red, straightened himself on the couch, and said, sir, do you really want to know? I replied, yes.
My wife and my son were there as well. And so he taught us the first lesson about the priesthood. Elder McIntyre spoke about the priesthood, how everything had happened. Along the way, as we asked questions, he answered them. Elder McIntyre really was a very well-prepared missionary. None of our questions were left unanswered. He answered all of them. He recovered his tranquility and started talking again. I believe that that day we were taught all of the lessons.
They gave the lesson exactly. They talked about Adam and Eve, the beginning, pre-existence. They explained our life here and explained about the sin of Cain and how the descendants of Cain had negated their right to the priesthood, and that those of his lineage were recognized by the dark color of their skin. And even if these people recognized the possibility of gaining, by their faithfulness, all of the blessings that Heavenly Father had reserved for the faithful, up until that moment, those people couldn't have the priesthood. However, all those who accepted the gospel could hope to enjoy all of its blessings like any other person. And they actually said that after they were baptized and learning about the church, they believed that perhaps black men could hold the priesthood during the millennium. That was kind of the hope that saw them through. So in the rest of the interview, Brother and Sister Marchines talk about their reaction to hearing about the revelation that all worthy men could hold the priesthood. Their son Marcos at the time was engaged to be married. The wedding announcements had been sent out. He postpones his wedding in order to serve a mission. And Marcos Marchines later served as a mission president, and he's currently the associate dean for religious education at BYU Hawaii.
Padre's mission president as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And they talk about attending the temple dedication in São Paulo and their service in various callings. And like Suzanne mentioned, Elvesio Marchines was just like, you know, he was stake executive secretary, and then he was in a bishopric, and then he was bishop, and then in a stake presidency, and then mission president. And as we mentioned before, in April of 1990, he was called to the Second Quorum of the 70, the first black general authority of the church. And these are just some images of, you know, Brazilians today. And so you can see, even in the congregation, that maybe some of those people wouldn't have been able to pass the lineage test in the 60s or 70s. Any comments from you guys before we open it up to...
Talking about Elvesio Marchines, it's really interesting because I don't know if we mentioned this earlier, but a lot of the interviewees, they knew each other. You know, either they're from the same ward or the same stake, or they served missions together. I don't remember who it was exactly, but there was one that I was translating who talked about Elvesio and how before the revocation of the priesthood ban, he was so firm in the church. And he was quite upset, actually, at the members in his ward for not fellowshipping them, his family, in the way that he thought they should. And he said something to the effect of, if something happens to me and my family, then it's going to be your fault. So the priesthood ban had so many implications, just so many implications. And I think these interviews are a great way to just kind of take a deep dive into this, the psyche of those implications in Brazil, of the people who were actually affected by it.
I think it's really interesting that even in the, like when lineage is brought up, and I think Mark Grover asks about it in almost every single interview, and it's just some of the interviewers or interviewees that talk a little bit more about it. It was interesting for me to see that it really came down to how the missionary handled the situation, about how this person's reaction was. If the missionary simply like asked, they talked about some missionaries would just ask to see family photo albums, and if they saw any evidence, they left. And then there were other missionaries who still took the time to talk to these families, to teach them the gospel, and they were still welcome at church, but they made sure they knew about some of the restrictions on the priesthood at the time. So I think for me it was really interesting just to see how much difference fellowshipping and missionary work could still make, even though these members weren't able to receive all the blessings of the priesthood. And that was really interesting for me. And I mean, today in Brazil, it's such a mixed country that I know that in the early days of the church, the priesthood ban was really seen as a struggle. And this idea of the lineage of Cain was really hard, not just for missionaries, but also for members. But seeing Brazil today and how much it's flourished is just a really big testimony of the revelation and the words that we receive from the prophet and how it blesses those that are striving to find the truth within the gospel.